It's great to be with you guys tonight. I'm really excited just always when I get the opportunity to be here and just to have a chance to share with you guys and hang out with you guys and just kind of wrestle with you guys through the realities of what it means to follow Jesus, because that is a complex and complicated and confusing and difficult thing to do a lot of the times while we journey through this life and through the things that we're doing. So tonight, hopefully, as I share with you guys some of the things that God has just been doing in my life over the last few weeks, I just hope and pray that they'll resonate with you and that there'll be a little nugget in here somewhere that you can carry home with you and that it will shape and change in some ways your life as the Spirit of God works through you. So really excited to be with you guys tonight. I don't know about you guys, but I often think about imaginary things and wonder how they're going to play out. Like I spend time thinking about things like if I was standing on the edge of a bridge and a plane crashed into an icy river and people were trying to get out of the plane, would I jump into the river and rescue people at the risk of losing my own life, or would I stand by and watch quietly? I think about what it might be like to drive down the highway and have a big car accident happen and there are flames everywhere. Would I drive by? Would I stop and watch? Would I pull over, jump out of the car and run into the flaming fire and drag people out as I rescue them? I don't know if you guys have ever had these thoughts, but I have them all the time. I wonder all the time when life comes around, when it comes at me in moments that I don't expect and that I'm not ready for, how will I be defined in those moments? What will come out? What part of me will emerge? I have thoughts about things like, I get the phone call and my family's been in a car accident and they're all gone. What will I do? What will my faith do? What will my heart do? I mean, I think about these things because those moments matter to me. They matter because when those moments come and I least expect them, I want to be able to walk into them and walk through them in a manner that would demonstrate what I have said I have believed all of these years. And there's certain things in my life, certain things that I don't really totally have to wonder about. There are those things about me that I think I've learned enough about and I've watched enough and I've seen enough circumstances take place in my life that I'm pretty certain now about how I'm going to respond in those moments. There are the kinds of things perhaps in your life that I would ask this way: what is the line you know you will never cross? Like, you know, you just know. I mean, you can take it all the way. I mean, would you ever get out of your car in a rage with a baseball bat and start smashing the car in front of you because they cut you off and see the person slowly die as you beat them to death with a baseball bat? And you go, what? I mean, would you cross that line? I've taken it all the way to the very end. It was in a movie, and I wondered about that at one point. Would I ever do that? I wonder. I've been in traffic, and there have been feelings. But... But then the line sort of moves backwards, right? But there's a certain point, I think, where you can draw a line in the sand and go, I wouldn't cross this one. I just know that about myself. I just know that. For me, I think that line exists in the area of parenting, in the area of father and child relationship. I am one of those guys that just, there's a lot of things I don't do well and a lot of things I don't get right. I'm very unreliable. I'm a promise maker more than I am a promise keeper. I mean, I can go on and on. There's a long list of incredible, horrible things about me. But this one is not horrible. I was born to be a dad. I just know it. As long as I can think back, as long as I can remember from the time I was little, I just always loved kids, loved being around them, always wanted to be a dad. And when I got to be a dad, that was a huge thing for me. I just knew that life would never be a struggle for me in the area of priorities where I would place all sorts of priorities ahead of my kids because I want to be home. I want to be with those children. And so I've always believed about myself and known about myself that when it comes down to it, when it matters, in those moments that matter, when my kids need me, I know I will be there for them. I know I will. If it's ever between them and anyone else on the planet, anyone else on the planet loses and they win. And I've always been the dad that, if I may even put it this way, have prided myself in the fact that my kids have a dad that when they need a hug or they need to be held or they need comfort or that I'm going to do it. It's just never been a huge issue for me. We went on vacation this last summer. We always go on vacation for 3 weeks over the summer. I've learned that it's the only way I can actually vacation is getting away for 3 weeks. And we go up to North Carolina. My parents have a home up there, and it's always great to go there and hang out. And we just have these 3 weeks of family time and friend time and crazy time. And inevitably, on my 3-week vacation, God always does something insane. And so I'm always excited now going on vacation. I literally go going, okay, God, what cool thing are you going to do in my life that I can bring back and share with everybody? And this three-week vacation was no exception. So we went up there, and one of those defining moments happened to me, one of those things that come around that shape you and just kind of confirm in you what you already know about yourself, what you already see. One day, early on in the vacation, it was probably 3 or 4 days in, we were there as a family, and my brother-in-law, my wife's sister's husband, he brought their two kids down. My wife's sister had not come down yet for the week. She was going to be down for the last 2 days, and so he came down bringing the two kids. He's a pilot, so he was only going to be there for 1 day, drop the kids off, and then head out, and then she was going to come after that. So there was a two-day period or so where we would have our 8 kids and her 2 kids, and it would be my wife and I and my wife's parents, and you know, they kind of hang out in the home and read books, and so it was going to be us and the 10 kids. And we were excited about that. Well, the first day, my brother-in-law arrives. He likes to surf, and so he gets there and he brings his big 9-foot surfboard with him, and he's got that. And the very first day we're there, he says, he gets there right after lunch. We've already been on the beach. We got back from the beach. My kids all kind of were done with the sand for a little bit. I was done with it, and I went and took a shower, and it's about 3 p.m, maybe even 4 o'clock. And I've just gotten out of the shower, and I threw on these shorts and this shirt, and it's kind of cool because I'm not a big clothes guy. I'm one of those guys that, as you can tell, I just walk into the closet, I grab what I see first, and I put it on. And then as I walk out of the closet, my wife goes, "That doesn't match." And then I go back in, and I try again, and then she just walks in and pulls some things out and hands them to me. So that's about my full experience with clothing. When I go shopping for clothes, ideally I don't. Ideally, she goes and she tries them on and then bring, no, she doesn't do that, but she goes and she, if she even comes home with clothes and says, "Can you try some of these on?" I just go, "Look, just pick a few, put them in my closet." I just don't care. But on this particular day, it was just kind of one of those moments. I put these new shorts that she'd bought for me. They're white shorts with this pattern on them, kind of cool. And this blue shirt, there's a V-neck, brand new shirt she'd bought. I'd never worn it before, and I put it on. And I got to say, perhaps for the very first time in my life, I mean, this is possible a first life experience, I just looked in the mirror, and I was like, I like this outfit. I mean, I do. I like the shirt, like these pants. This was a good choice. I wanted to go outside, find my wife, and say, "Well done." I mean, I like them. It's a unique feeling. And so anyways, I just done that, and my brother-in-law arrives, and I'm out there, and I hear my brother-in-law say, "Hey, I'm gonna go surf for a little bit." I just kind of, you know how you hear a noise in the background, and he kind of heads out. And then after a few minutes, I realize in the back of my mind, as he said that, I heard the sliding glass door open and close several times, which only means one thing, that he was not the only one that went out. So as I go to the glass door and I look out, I see him on the boardwalk heading toward the beach, and behind him are his 2 kids and several of mine, okay? So at this point now I'm like, okay, Brooke's upstairs, she's getting dinner ready, I'm here, he's on his way to go surf, and Dan's kind of a pilot, so he's one of those guys that's like, "Oh, it's cool, let's go," and off he goes down the boardwalk, and the last 2 of my kids shoot their way down and off they're going on the boardwalk. So 10 children and the laid-back pilot are on their way to the beach with a 9-foot surfboard. I'm like, this is not a scenario you want to be part of. And all my daddy stuff starts kicking in, and I go, I've got to go and rescue a whole bunch of people, including probably most importantly the poor man with the surfboard. And so I take off down the boardwalk. By this time, by the time it all fits in, I'm running down and I'm running across the boardwalk. They're already on the beach. And this particular beach is a wide beach, so it's one of those beaches that once you hit the sand, you got to go quite a distance before you get to the water. And so when I'm coming off the boardwalk, I look into the distance, and all 10 children run into the ocean, one of which is 5, and then of the 10, there are only 3 that are not under the age of 10. Okay, so calculate that, okay? And they're all in the water now with my brother-in-law with a 9-foot surfboard. Okay, and as I'm running, I already know what's going to happen. The first thing that's going to happen is my 5-year-old, the insane one, is going to want to try to surf. So I could have written this script, right? I look out, and he's already clambering onto the surfboard. So my brother-in-law is about waist deep in the water. He's holding a 9-foot surfboard. Cole is standing on the surfboard, 5 years old. He's like, "I'm surfing!" He watched Surf's Up, and then what was the other one with the girl, the arm thing? Yeah, that one. He watched that, and so he wants to surf now. And so he's on the board, and he's all cool. And my brother-in-law, He's on the surfboard, and I'm watching. I'm running down the beach at this point, and I see my other two sons start swimming over toward the surfboard. I'm like, here it comes. And so Mahari, my 10-year-old son, he clambers onto the board while Cole is on the board. There are waves. And my brother-in-law does what any normal thinking person would do in that scenario, right? There's now two boys on the board. One has already been on the board. So what you do is you just remove one off the board and deliver them into the ocean. The only thing is generally when they're 5 years old and you deliver them into the ocean, you just want to kind of get a quick take on everything and go, okay, you know, swim back to the shore, you're good. Now, my 5-year-old's a good swimmer, but this is the ocean, right? So as he's being delivered into the ocean, I'm running now down the beach, right? And I'm like running, and I'm like, oh, come on, no, not in the ocean. And I'm just thinking, I got to get there fast, just in case Cole gets in some trouble. And then it happens. I mean, this is no joke. I mean, it was like watching it before my very eyes. I look right behind the surfboard, and if you've been in the ocean any period of time in your life, you know how you can kind of see the swells building. And if you've ever surfed or done any of that stuff, which I grew up boogie boarding, I love the ocean. So I just see it. I'm like, there is a swell building behind my brother-in-law that is not looking like a happy swell. And as I'm running, I see it build, and it dawns on me, this may be the biggest wave that I've seen on the vacation up to now, and it's coming at them, and he doesn't see it because he's got his back to the wave, and he's got the board, and he's got Mahari, and he's got Cole in this arm, and he is delivering him into the ocean right at the point where the swell's coming. If he had seen it, there may have been a different decision, but he doesn't see it. So I'm now screaming, no, like that, and I'm running, and I'm like, I've got to get there because I know what that wave's going to do. It is going to lift Cole off his feet, and it is going to deliver him into the sand and then cover him with a whole large body of water. And it's just going to ask the question, will he live? And I've got to be there to make sure I get him as he comes out of that mess. The one thing I did not anticipate in the equation was this. Just as the swell hits my brother-in-law and he lets go of Cole, he's just let him go and he's turned to Mahari, he sees the swell, he grabs Mahari and pulls back. Mahari comes off the board and the board gets caught in the wave and just starts swinging really fast this way, and I see it in slow motion. I am running like this and I see Cole being lifted up by the wave, panic in his eyes, I was close enough to see that, and he turns like this and the board comes around and I literally see it like in the movie. The board connects with his face, and he just goes like this. I mean, you know, the dribble comes out, and teeth are flying, like, ah. And as it hits him in the face at full speed, he's 5 years old, as it hits him, the wave chooses at that moment to deliver him into the sand, right? So this is Cole's experience, right? Delivered, what? I know that's what's going on, right? So I run as fast as I can. At this point, I get to the ocean, and as I go knee-deep into the ocean, I just see arms and legs and stuff, and I'm like, there's Cole, and I reach down, and I grab him, and I pull him up, and as I pull him out of the ocean, literally as he comes out, just blood everywhere. I mean, it's on his mouth, it's on his chest, it's everywhere. So I lift him up, and I'm like, oh, no. And I just know it hit him in the face. There's stuff broken. What's going on? So immediately, I assess the situation. I look eyes up, and I'm like, okay, his eyes are open. That means the board did not connect this way, which is great. The blood's coming from down here. That's fixable. So I pull him up, but there's so much blood, I can't tell. Has it ripped his jaw off? What has it done? So I run out onto the ocean. I'm dragging my son. I get to the towel, and I start dabbing. I just want to assess where is the blood coming from so I can decide how big of a deal this is. And while I'm doing this, my brother-in-law, like any person whose surfboard just connected with a 5-year-old, comes running out to me, and he goes, is he okay? Is he okay? And as I'm hearing the words, I realize 9 children in a big wave drowning. This is not the time for 2 adults to be dealing with a 5-year-old. And I'm like, get back in the ocean. The others, get them, because they're small too. And he kind of goes, okay. And he runs back in the ocean. And I look at Cole, and he's bleeding, and I touch, and I realize he has a laceration that runs straight down here. Not a huge deal. I don't know if the tooth came through. I haven't assessed that yet. But at least I know right now, from what I can tell, it's just a decent laceration. It's going to bleed a lot. The mouth bleeds a lot. So I know what I got to do is get him home. Just got to get him to the house, and when we get to the house, I can fix this. So I grab him by the arm, right? And Cole right now is disoriented. He's screaming his head off. There's blood everywhere. He's 5. He's been hit in the mouth by a 2x4, a big surfboard. He is panicking, right? I mean, he is panicking. I literally had the thought he may go into shock, right? That's how bad of a state he was in. So I grab him by the arm like this. I'm mad at the entire situation. I'm mad at the world. I'm mad at the ocean. I'm mad at the other 9 kids for being in the ocean. I'm mad at him for being here. I'm mad at me. I'm just mad at everybody. And I grab him like this by the arm and I'm like, you've got to run. And we start running down the beach. I mean, we are running and I am running. So you can imagine a 5-year-old running next to me, right? He's dragging and he's screaming and he's crying and he's like, it hurts. I'm like, I know. Just run, because I'm thinking I've got to get back to the house in time to get my wife back out to the ocean to help Dan rescue the other 9 children, because Cole's not going to die, but they might. And so it's like everything's running through my head. There is one other thought that is running through my head at that moment. As I've got Cole by the arm and I'm dragging him across a beach and he's running down a boardwalk, do you have any idea why I was dragging my son along the beach? Because you would think, wouldn't you, that in that scenario, I would pick him up. He's 5. I can handle this. I would hold him to me, and I would run with my son in my arms because he needs to calm down, and it would be much faster. Dragging him in the sand slows me down as well as him. I'll tell you exactly why. Because I was wearing my nice new outfit that I liked for the first time in my life. That's not a joke. The thought actually crossed my mind. I am not getting blood on my white pants today. It's not okay. I like my shirt. I like my pants. And I don't know about like washing blood out. I remember when I was little, somehow my mom said, if blood gets on your clothes, that's it. So I'm like, this could be the end of this outfit. It's the first outfit I've ever liked. And my son is not going to destroy that for me right now. And you have to realize that that is such a little moment. It's such a little thing, isn't it? It's a shirt and it's a pants and it's a boy and I'm dragging him and he didn't die and I rescued him and everything is fine. But I got to tell you guys, when I got back to the house and the panic subsided and the calm came and my son was fine and we got the cut fixed up and my wife rescued the other children, I was sitting there and as everything just kind of came to a still, it all came back to me. It all did. It all rushed back into my mind. In a single moment, when the core of who I know I am, the line I know I will never cross, not only did I violate my core as dad, not only did I drag my son bleeding through the sand on the beach, not only did I not do everything I know in my core I always do, hold him close, comfort him, protect him, and keep him safe, but listen to this, I did it for the one thing that matters least to me. It was as though God designed this moment for me to show me how absolutely unthinkable I could be at any given moment. I chose clothes over the comfort that my son needed in that moment. I mean, you could almost give me anything else to pick. Anything but clothes, please, just not clothes, because I don't like clothes. I think they're stupid. And that's what God said you're going to pick over your child. And I believe in hindsight now that it was an important moment for me just to recognize how absolutely close I am at any given moment to crossing the lines that I know I will never cross. Doing the things I know I will never do. Violating the cores that are deep inside of me. And giving up moments with my child to protect an outfit. And in that moment, I remember when it all came back to me, a grief that I haven't felt in a very long time began to sink over me. That night, for the first time in a long time, I lay in my bed and I wept that night. I just cried because it begged a deep question for me. If I could so easily violate the very thing I know I will never do, is there anything in my life that is safe? Is there any line I would not cross? If I could have picked an outfit over that moment of all moments, what would I not be capable of doing now? See, it pulled from under me the rug of security that I held onto that was me. That because I am who I am, I know certain things about what is safety for me. It pulled that rug right out from under my feet and it left me totally vulnerable to everything horrible. And I laid in my bed that night and I cried. I woke up the next morning to a thought. It was lingering in my mind as I opened my eyes. I remember it was as though the Spirit of God just sat by my bedside, and at the moment I opened my eyes, he brought to my mind his word in a manner as though to whisper to me, we've got a journey to take, you and me, and I want to start you with this. When you lay in a bed and you weep because you have crossed the lines you know you would never cross, done the things you know you would never do, done things that you might even say are unredeemable at that moment. This you can never take this back. Where do you go from there? And that was the question that lingered as I fell asleep. Where do I go from here, God? What do I do now? And this was the first answer that he gave me. In the book of Galatians in chapter 5, a passage that I love deeply and have memorized many times, and so it was available to the Spirit of God in my mind to bring, but he brought it to me right in this moment. In verse 1 of Galatians chapter 5, page 632 of these Bibles that we have for you guys here, it says these words, "For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to the yoke of slavery." Let me read that again. "For freedom, Christ has set us free." What an odd statement, isn't it? I've set you free for freedom. It is for freedom that I have set you free. I didn't set you free for slavery or bondage. I set you free so that you can be free. It sounds obvious, doesn't it? But it's so necessary for us to hear that. I did not do everything I did for you just so you can be bound again by something else. I've set you free for freedom once and for all. It's done. So whatever you do, do not yoke yourself again, bind yourself again to the yoke of slavery that once was yours. See, in the rest of this passage in Galatians chapter 5, Paul is actually writing about, in essence, legalism. He's saying to the people he's writing to in Galatia, listen, you lived under the law once, and the law in its basic demand was this. Here are the things you have to do to stay right with God, and you need to do them, and if you don't do them, then you need to make things right through sacrifice and through festivals and through other things. And so there was always a process by which you had to come and clean again before God. And God did that intentionally to demonstrate to humanity the reality and need that we had for the redemptive nature of Jesus and what he's done. And so here Paul is writing and saying, guys, don't you get it? Jesus has done a work for us that has freed us forever. It's done. It's finished. We are free from the most incredible things. We are free from the very things in which we think we will never violate. We are free. He set us free from those. So don't, when you find yourself stuck, don't yoke yourself again, bind yourself again to this reality, this idea that somehow now you must once again go and make things right in order to be free. There's the key, in order to be free. Because it is for freedom that he has already set you free. So imagine this, right? One of the most deeply difficult things that I have experienced in a long time, violating my own core. And the first words my Savior says to me the next morning is, I've already set you free from this. Don't worry. You are still free. Nothing has changed. You are still free. Let's start there. Because when we are bound to our own sin after being freed by the redemptive work of Jesus, when we are bound to our own sin again, it does not lead us into greater freedom. It binds us to a slavery that no longer needs to be ours. You see, our freedom is that when we fail, we can walk through it because we are already free from it. And then we can walk into greater things. So God begins with this. I have set you free. That is enough. There is nothing else we need to know for now. Just know that you are free. And he wanted me to linger in that freedom for a while. Do you believe that Jesus is enough for your failures? Do you believe that Jesus is enough when you violate the very things you don't believe you ever will? When you make the mistakes you never thought you would? When you do the things you never believed you were capable of? Do you believe that Jesus' redemptive reality is still enough for you? If you don't, you don't know how big Jesus is. You don't know how freeing his wonderful work is. And so once again, I was reminded of how free I am. You see, the way that the gospel is supposed to work is this. We travel through life, and we come to discover at a certain point in our journey that we are unclean, we are sinful, and we need a Savior because we can't cleanse ourselves. And so we discover Jesus, and we discover his redemptive work on the cross and his resurrection, and we're like, wow. And we discover the gospel. And for those of you that have ever walked that path and discovered that, you know in that moment the incredible freedom that happens when you first discover Jesus. But then you know what the Christian church tends to do? We tend to do this. You've got the gospel now, and you've experienced that, so let's move on towards spiritual maturity. And then we all get better and better, more like Jesus, and so the gap between our depravity and God's holiness diminishes over time. We think of ourselves as better and better, and because we're functioning so much and trying to make ourselves better, God just kind of stays here. But here's how the journey is supposed to work. After you discover the gospel, after you discover how depraved you are and how much you need a Savior, then your journey should continue from there into your own depravity and into God's magnificent holiness. You see, you're supposed to journey from there, and the longer you live, the more you realize how capable you are of terrible things. And the more you start realizing, you mean me? You mean that's me? I am that unclean without you? Yes. And you are that holy? Yes. And so by the time you get to the end of your life, here's what happened. Here's how you thought you were when you discovered Jesus. Here's how you thought God was, and that was the cross. It bridged that gap between your depravity and God's holiness, and you were in awe of the cross. Wow, that's a serious work Jesus has done. But look what happens. As you discover God's holiness more throughout your life and your own depravity more throughout your life, by the time you get to be like old, right, you look and go, I had no idea how big the cross was. And the gospel continues to become greater and greater in our lives rather than smaller and smaller. So when we recognize our depravity, in the moments we violate the very things we think we could hold on to, it is an incredible opportunity for the gospel once again to make itself known. And in that moment, Jesus demonstrates to us that the gospel finished its work once and for all when you discover Jesus as Savior, and yet it continues its work every day in you. What kind of a thing finishes its work and yet continues its work simultaneously? Only the gospel. Only the gospel. It rescued you once and for all, and it rescues you every day. And so that verse comes to mind, and this was the next one that popped into my mind throughout that day. That verse where Paul is writing in the book of Romans, and he says this, where sin increases, there also grace increases. See, we sometimes think of that verse, Paul actually says it. He says, so should we therefore continue to sin more greatly so that we can see greater grace? And he goes, are you out of your mind? That would be insane. Your sin will increase by natural cause if you're following Jesus, because why? You will recognize it more. It's not that it gets bigger, it's that you just see it for what it was in the very beginning. And the greater you recognize your sin to be, the greater you will recognize God's grace to be. So think of this. What the enemy came in to derail in my life, to cause me to recognize how bad I was, and despite the fact that I followed Jesus all this time, and despite the fact that I believe I am a dad at the very core of who I am, that even is called into question. And when the enemy was about to whisper to me and to say, you thought you could call yourself a Christ follower, the Spirit of God whispered to me and said, look deeply into the gospel and see how big it is. Let this moment of failure only increase the wonder of the one who has saved you. And instead of feeling discouragement, I felt a sense of awe in what Jesus has done for me, that even in that moment, he was enough. You would think God would stop there, but he didn't. The next thing that came to mind later in the day, I was thinking about all this and meditating on it, and then it came to me. God spoke Philippians chapter 1 to me. In Philippians chapter 1, Paul is writing, and he mentions this wondrous and amazing thing to the church in Philippi. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 6, it says this. I want you to listen to this. Paul says, and I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. It was as though God said to me, Renaud, one, let's just meditate on this. When you fail, you are still free. Enough said. Number two, when you fail, I am only still continuing a work in you that I have already begun and that I will complete. So it's as though Jesus was saying, your failure only demonstrates two things, the magnitude of my redemption and the wonder of the work I'm effecting in you. Because I love you so much that I have already redeemed all of your failures. And I love you so much that when you fail, I will not leave you in your failure, but I will call you out of your failure. You see, what God constantly does in our lives is this. He demonstrates when we fail how free we are. And then in the recognition of that freedom, he grows us so that next time around, we won't pick our white pants over our son. Next time around, we will do it better. Not because we are better, but because we have more deeply recognized that he is better and he is bigger than we thought. And so the work that God is at work doing in your life today, the work that so often feels so distant to you because you are failing so often and you feel like you spend more time not doing what Jesus wants you to do than doing what he wants you to do, it is that very work that he is completing in you. And that is almost an addition to what was already a great freedom. Our great freedom is that we are free when we fail. Our greater freedom is that after we have failed and we have been recognized that we are free, he calls us into obedience. Because obedience is our greater freedom. Redemption is great freedom. And then on this planet, obedience is now the result of redemption. Because before, remember, before Christ redeemed us, this is what the Bible says. What the law was unable to do, and that it was weakened by our sinful nature, Christ had to do. You wanted to obey, but you could not. Now that you've been redeemed, you want to obey, and the work that he's doing in you is continually moving you closer to the ability to obey. Our obedience is our freedom. As much as our redemption has set us free forever, our obedience continues to set us free on this planet every day. And we are called into both. So, I thought the journey was done. I did. I was like, that's good, God, that's good. And I actually asked God if he would do another cool thing during the 3 weeks because I did not want to share that horrible story with the entire church. And God didn't do anything else, and so he kept telling me, that's the story I want you to tell. I'm like, can't we just pick a good one for once? Does it always have to be my depravity that comes out on vacation? God was like, well, you keep acting depraved, so it works out well. So that was the story that was born. But I felt like God was done, but then it dawned on me. For many of you, as is true for me, when we travel through the intellectual reality of things, they are neat and they do give us something to hold on to, but they don't speak here often, right? Here, in that place, deep down, in the soul. And so it was as though God wanted to say, Renaud, all of this is true and you know that here, but before we're done with the story, I want you to feel it here. I want you to know this in a way that is soul-knowing rather than just head-knowing. And so he took me to another beach. Another beach in another moment that took place. There was a man in Scripture, his name was Peter, one of my favorite characters in Scripture, just because he reminds me so much of my five-year-old son. He thinks after he's acted, he has no fear, he's spontaneous, but in a bad sort of a way. He does really, really stupid things and thinks they're really cool, and it sort of comes to him later what he did. Right? So he was the one that constantly corrected Jesus. I mean, at a certain point, Peter discovered Jesus was God. Peter was the one that said, where shall I go? You have the words of eternal life. And then continued to correct Jesus after that on several occasions. Once you discover someone is God, just, you know, generally speaking, you go, I'm not going to correct you anymore. And to the very Last Supper, Peter always corrected Jesus. You're not doing that. You're not going there. And Jesus would always go, look, would you just step back? Okay. I love Peter. Peter didn't know much about himself. He was very unpredictable and all over the place. But I think if you could sit Peter down and you could ask him, Pete, if there's one thing that you know you just defines who you are, what would that be? And I think if you asked him that, certainly one of the things he would say is that when everybody else gives up, when everybody else deserts, when everybody else leaves, when everybody else is finished, count on me still being there, ready to fight. How do I know this? Am I just making this stuff up? No, I mean, follow the life of Peter, right? Peter is the one that tells Jesus, Listen, wherever you go, I'll go. Peter is the one that is the first to step in. Peter is the one that at the Last Supper says to Jesus, I will never, ever leave what you're going to do. Peter is the one that in the garden when Jesus is being betrayed, right, and the soldiers are coming and the priests are there to come and arrest him, Peter is the one who is stupid enough to pull his sword out and go, you want to get to him? You go through me. You have to understand, when Peter does that, we know the story. Peter cuts the ear off the guy's face, and it was like this neat little moment in time, and Jesus heals the guy. But what we don't anticipate in that story is this, that when Peter pulled his sword, for all intent and purposes, he knew in that moment he was going to die. Because there was a bunch of Roman soldiers there, and you don't pull your sword on a bunch of Roman soldiers and not die. So you have to understand, Peter is the guy that was willing to give his life to rescue Jesus. That's Peter. So what do you think is the single most devastating thing that could happen to a man who believed at his core that when everybody else failed the master, he wouldn't? I'll tell you what the most devastating thing that could happen to a guy like that would be. That on the very night when Jesus needed him most, he, for no reason whatsoever, denied him three times. You have to go and read the story. It wasn't like they came to Peter and said, if you tell me that you know Jesus, we are going to arrest you and kill you. One of it was around a fire and a bunch of people were like, do you know Jesus? No. Like, it was my clothes moment. It was Peter afterwards going, thinking back and going, why on earth? I mean, if I'm going to deny him, let it be as they're trying to burn my body in flames. Please, just not on the evening that Jesus is arrested, where I have no consequence other than simply saying, no, I don't know him. And at the moment that he had denied him three times, the rooster sounded its call. And it says, Peter went and he wept. He wept. Because he knew everything he had lived his life to do was finished. Everything Jesus had said he would be was finished. That he was going to be a rock in the church and a man that would carry the church and feed the lambs and the sheep and lead the cause. All of it was gone. Because when you're that kind of a man, when you believe that wholeheartedly in the fact that you will be loyal, that you know that's why Jesus chose you, when that is gone, all is lost. And for Peter, all was lost. He went back to fishing. So it's done. It's finished. In the book of John, there is a moment that happens here. And this is the beach Jesus took me to. I love that it's a beach. And I love that it's this moment. John chapter 21, page 590 of the Bibles you have. John chapter 21, in verse 15, Jesus has now resurrected. He's come back from the dead. He's visited the disciples on several occasions. So Pete's been around him a couple of times, right? And you know this has been lingering as an elephant in the room. I mean, you know, right? Because when you've done something to someone and they know you've done it and you're not sure if they know that you've done it or not, because I'm sure Peter was like, does he know? Does he know? I mean, he knew that Jesus said he would, but did Jesus really know that he had? And if so, how does Jesus feel about him and what's going on? And can he still be part of the story? And if he is, what part of the story does he get to be? A small part or a big part? I don't know. And all of that must be running through his head. And then here in John chapter 21, it says these words in verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? What an odd question to ask. Do you love me more than these? Have you ever asked like a friend of yours, do you love me more than they love me? It's not a normal, like appropriate question to ask, is it? I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, I don't go to my kids and go, do you love me more than Mahadi loves me? I mean, just, you can tell me. You can do it. I mean, this is not appropriate. Why would Jesus ask it, right? The other 12 are right. I mean, at this point, the other 11, they're there. And Jesus is going, do you love me more than they do? Why would Jesus ask this question? Because Jesus must speak back into Peter something Peter believed about himself that has been lost. And Jesus must remind Peter of something. So he says to Peter, do you love me more than they do? This is what Peter believed about himself before he denied Jesus, that he would love Jesus more than they did. And Jesus asks him the question, and the answer should be no. So Peter doesn't say no, and he doesn't say yes. He simply says this, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He's not confident enough to say yes, doesn't totally want to say no. Feed my lambs, Jesus says.
He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Now, I love this. Peter was grieved because he had said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. I mean, come on. Do you see what's happening here? Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Look what just happened. Peter has just reminded himself of something. God knows everything, and God knows that Peter loves him. So what does that mean Peter should know? That he loves God. If God knows it, then surely Peter doesn't have the right to define himself as a failure. And Jesus says to him, then feed my sheep. I have stood on that beach. I don't know about you, but I have. This wasn't the first time. It was just a time that spoke deeply to me, but I have stood on that beach where I have recognized that I've done something that crossed a line. Crossed a line I could never go and take back. And I've wondered in those moments what this means. And here's what I've discovered. I will cross the line again. As a matter of fact, just 3 weeks after this incident, on the very weekend, I preached this last weekend at the Oakland campus. I had an incident with one of my other children that I haven't had in a long time. I screamed at him at the top of my voice on the stairs. I was mad and angry. I don't get mad and angry. I don't lose my temper. It's not something I do. I did that day. So much so that my entire household was shocked by what I'd done. And in that very moment, Jesus says, Renaud, you will do this plenty of times, and I will be enough every time. But I will not leave you here. I will walk you through this into obedience. Because you are not going to use your freedom to indulge your sinful nature. You are going to learn to use your freedom to love the world with my love and change it. You will become better than you could have ever been because I will become bigger in you than you ever imagined. I thank God that I have stood on Peter's beach because it is only on Peter's beach that Jesus gets to sit with you and say, do you still love me? Do you? And only you can answer that question. God, you know everything. And though I do not feel like I love you because of what I've done, you know I love you. And that's enough for me, for now. I don't know what you failed in, and I don't know what you will fail in the future. But I have no doubt the older you get, the bigger they will become. When you fail, please hear me. Your freedom is to recognize how deeply free you are and then to walk out of your failure and remind yourself that you don't get to define yourself. Only Jesus gets to do that. And he has already defined you. He has already told you you are rescued, you are free, you are mine, and I love you. And that's enough. And when you discover that as deeply as I tend to discover it in my moments of depravity, I pray for you what has been true for me in many of those moments. That instead of using that freedom to indulge my sinful nature and go and do it again and rest in it, it will become the very confidence and courage I need to walk out of my depravity into obedience and holiness. Not because I must, but because I can. And because I know that it is there that I will experience the full freedom of Jesus. I pray my story will in some way inspire you not only to realize the greatness of God's redemptive reality, but the incredible freedom you have to walk in obedience. And may we all, in our strengths and our failures, always continue to discover this to be true, that the gospel has redeemed us once for all, and yet it rescues us every day. Live there in the shadow of the cross, and there you will be free, free from your failures and free from your successes. You will be stuck there in the beauty and wonder of Jesus. Let's pray. God, thank you that the best of men, the best of women, have found themselves on Peter's beach, on my beach, doing something that they believed they would never do, and finding themselves weeping quietly in a room by themselves, not sure where to go. Thank you that it is in that room that you have set us free. Thank you that the consequences of our sin are no longer eternal. They no longer shape us and define us. But in fact, they do just the opposite now. They shape and define you. They shape and define the gospel. And they only make you greater and only prove your good news to be bigger than we could have imagined. You have truly set us free. I pray, God, for all of us, that the words you spoke in that same passage in Galatians at its very end will be true of us, that we would now not use our freedom to indulge our sinful nature, as we have the right to do because we are that free, but instead we would discover that freedom to be a call, an invitation into greatness, into holiness,